What is my connection to the Flying Frog Farm? Well, I guess the best way to answer that is just to give a little history. I met my wonderful friends at Towson State College in the late 60s. It was a kind of a turbulent time. And at some point, we decided that the best thing to do was to live in a different way that was more in tune with our beliefs. So live close to the land, live in peace, live communally, if you will.
I really wanted to be separate from consumer culture. I definitely wanted that. And I think also community. We started living in various combinations while we were still in school, and I wanted that to continue. I didn't want it to say, okay, those are disposable relationships.
It seemed more important somehow to learn how to grow organic beans and tomatoes and squash and learn the firewood characteristics of oak opposed to beech.
There was a mindset in general in those times that if it was something new and different, it was worth trying.
Those are some of the members of the Flying Frog Farm talking about their reasons for forming a commune in Allen County in the early 1970s. The voices we heard belonged to Paula Brach Brown, Al Levinson, Michael Gramling, and before that, Joy Gramling. And at the time, they were part of a group of counterculture hippies, many of whom had dropped out of college in order to live an alternate lifestyle. My name is Rachel Hopkin. I recently graduated from the WKU Folk Studies program, and in this documentary, I'll be finding out a little bit more about life in the commune. They chose to name it the Flying Frog Farm, apparently inspired by the band, the Flying Burrito Brothers, well before they laid eyes on this property. Sometime in 1971, though, they opened a bank account and started to actively and collectively save money to turn their dream into reality, as Michael Gramling recalls.
We would sit around and talk about it, and if someone came and visited us and heard us talking about our farm, they would say, "Where is it?" And we'd say, "Oh, well, we haven't bought it yet. We don't know where it is." And, you know, we would read about alternative ways to acquire property, like, here's land that you can get because it's been foreclosed on and there's going to be an auction, or there's this government land that you can get for this or that. And the thing about Feb, I think I have this right, I think Feb's mom was actually a real estate agent. So it occurred to Feb to do something that it would not have occurred to me to do, which was actually buy it in a normal way, go see a real estate agent.
Feb is February McClure, and in early 1972, she was in New Orleans for Mardi Gras. Someone she encountered there got to telling her how cheap land was in Kentucky. So rather than returning home directly to Baltimore, she hitchhiked to Bowling Green, where she met up with a man called Butch.
He was a notoriously unscrupulous real estate agent, I found out later. However, he showed me the property, and I had never been in such a rural place, and it was 168 acres that I thought was just lovely and the price was right. So I called and told them I had found this perfect place.
So we all drove up and we looked at it, and I just thought it was amazing. The hills, I mean, to this day, I think Kentucky is one of the most beautiful states I've ever seen. I love the rolling hills. I love the woods. So I thought, yeah, this is perfect.
In order to make the purchase, the group had to go back to see Butch.
We had a down payment, and he said, "Well, you can get the loan from any bank. Just sign here." We were very nervous about it because we weren't sure if a local bank was going to lend that kind of money to a bunch of long-haired hippies. And so we had the presence of mind to make the real estate agent sign a paper that said, "I guarantee the loan." And that was very wise, it turned out, because no local banks would loan us the money. If we hadn't had him sign that paper, we would have lost our $3,000.
When the resulting mortgage was drawn up, there were 11 names on it. While the soon-to-be frog farmers went back to Baltimore to prepare for their new life, word of their imminent arrival was spreading in Allen County. Billy Duncan owned, and still owns, the farm adjacent to where the Baltimore people had purchased their land.
What the real estate agent said was that he had sold the farm to a bunch of hippies. These old country stores where people sit around and talk. It was pretty much of a buzz for the month before they got here. Mainly it was just curiosity, you know, what are they going to be like, what are they going to do, and all this kind of stuff. Because nobody had any idea, nobody had any personal experience with supposedly hippies. Because out in here is a long ways from where hippies are normally seen.
I'm going up the country, baby, don't you want to go? I'm going up the country, baby, don't you want to go? I'm going to some place where I've never been before.
What the Baltimore group wanted to do was live close to the land together in harmony, grow their own food organically, and become self-sufficient. Move-in day was April the 2nd, 1972, which was already late in the growing season. The group had no previous experience of living a rural lifestyle, but they did not let that deter them.
We were serious about trying to raise a year's worth of fruit and vegetables. And we had a what was sort of the organic farmer's Bible at that point, Rodale, which you could flip through and look under squash, and it would say a 100-foot row of squash will produce so many bushels of squash. So we would do these ridiculous seat-of-the-pants calculations. Well, there's 12 of us, and we'll eat squash 3 times a week, and that means a quarter pound a person 3 times a week, so we better go out there and plant 400-foot rows of squash. So it was wildly irregular successes and failures in volumes and quantities.
And if you're an organic gardener, you have to have compost. So our first order of business was to make a compost heap. And one way you can do that is to chop up all the ingredients. You know, you have manure and you have grass and leaves and this and that, and you pile it all up and let it heat up and make fertilizer. But that happens over 6 months. In order to accelerate the process, you chop everything up really fine. So one memory I have is us with pieces of plywood and hatchets, and we were actually chopping up cow pies to put in our compost pile so we could make ourselves some fertilizer. Yeah, I know the locals were laughing at that one for sure.
We got a milk cow very early on. We got chickens very early on. And, you know, we had to learn everything from scratch. And a lot of things that we were learning how to do, people had quit doing, right? Folks still knew how to milk cows and they could show us, but there are very few people actually still milking cows back then.
The cow was called Josephine, and milking her was one of the tasks that was on a rota at the farm. The two other regularly assigned chores were bread making and housewife of the day.
Everyone would take turns preparing all the meals and cleaning up, as it were, each day. Of course, that varied from person to person how well that went.
Was there anybody whose rotation on housewife you dreaded?
Well, some people were better cooks than others. I won't mention any names, but there was always a lot of talk about cooking healthily, and you steamed vegetables rather than boiled them to preserve the nutrients. And for a lot of people, this was a very new concept. I don't think people had done a lot of their own cooking before. But one day I came into the kitchen when one of the men was being housewife that day, and I looked into the pot where spaghetti was supposed to be cooking, and there was about 2 inches of water, and all the spaghetti was leaning against the side of the pot. And I said, "What are you doing?" And this person said, "I'm steaming the spaghetti to preserve the nutrients."
See the logs on in the porch?
There was only one kitchen at the farm in those days, and in fact, that was the same one that was used in the preparations for this 40th reunion party.
I actually lived in that log cabin and the one behind the house.
The house that we were congregating around was the only property on the land in 1972 that had facilities, and it only had a couple of bedrooms. There were also two Spartan log cabins on the land.
Rustic, that's a word that applies to
that meant that aside from getting to grips with growing vegetables and bringing order to the daily chores, another issue the frog farmers faced early on was the need to build more accommodation for themselves and their many friends who would often pay them prolonged visits. So they decided that what they needed was to build a Buckminster Fuller-inspired dome.
We thought that's what we wanted to do. And again, I was always one that had the stupidest ideas, and I was lucky that nobody went along with this one. I said, let's put it on top of this house. So that way it'd be easier to heat and it would be easier to wire and whatever. We actually voted on that, and it was defeated by a narrow margin, thank God.
Instead, they decided to locate the dome on some land away from the house.
So we built this dome, but it was really difficult because every angle was different. And so I remember at the end, that last hub, putting it at the very top, getting it to fit. I think there were three or four guys up there with all their weight just laying on the top to try to get the last bolts in place. But I ended up living in the top of the dome, and I had several leaks. But I just put hanging plants like macrame hangers, and the water would follow the rope down and would not get the whole place wet. It would just stay in the saucer under the plant, and it was just pretty amazing how that worked out.
Whilst the frog farmers were settling in and adapting to their new home, their neighbors in Allen County were getting used to them. Remember, these were 1970s hippies in a place, as local farmer Billy Duncan put it earlier, where hippies were not usually seen.
People from around the area would drive by just so they could see what we looked like, especially at first. This happened all the time. We would have these people driving 5 miles an hour down Horseshoe Bend just to get a look at, you know, this strange bunch of kids who had moved here from the city.
The locals were very curious about us, of course. They didn't know what to expect from us. I mean, we could have been Charlie Manson-like. We could have been there to steal their chickens or, you know.
We were the free love generation, and we were living amongst people who were married and had children and were very much monogamous. And, you know, there were a lot of churchgoers there, and we weren't churchgoers. But we didn't think that was really that important. And there were some farmers in particular that I would like to mention who helped us immensely with equipment, and especially Billy Duncan, the next door neighbor.
And before too long at all, we were learning farmhand work, because that's what the local community really saw in us, that all of a sudden there were these pool of labor available to them.
And that's how we really made the connection with our neighbors, because you work in the fields side by side all day long in the hot sun, and you're going to bond, you know.
Come a little bit closer, hear what I have to say. Just like sleeping, we could dream this night away.
I think once people got to know us, that they thought we were as quaint in choosing to live the way that we were choosing to live as we perhaps thought they were quaint when we first moved there. One funny thing is that in the style of hippies or freaks, we wore old patched clothes that we patched ourselves. It was quite a badge of honor. And I think when the local people saw us walking around dressed like that, they didn't realize that it was a choice. So people would bring clothes by the truckload. And there were all these fabulous handmade dresses from the 50s and 60s that we just became totally enamored with. And I might point out that one of our friends was David Byrne of later the Talking Heads. And it was there that I feel I can quite safely say that David got the idea of wearing the enormous suits that he used to wear on stage when Talking Heads were quite famous, because I can remember him walking around the farm wearing these enormous suits. Everyone, it was an enormous dress-up party for that whole summer, I think.
One night, a friend invited us to go and play volleyball at another farmer's house, young farmer. And at one point, one of the local guys got hit in the face with a ball, or hit himself in the face with a ball or something. And he said, "I can't believe I ate the whole thing," which was from a popular
Alka-Seltzer commercial.
That was really so ubiquitous that even we knew it, and we rarely watched TV. And this was like a revelatory moment for me that this was an entirely different culture, but it wasn't really, because everybody in America was saying, I can't believe I ate the whole thing. It sort of told me something. This guy had a different accent, a different life, but my belief that these were entirely different people, they weren't. They were watching TV. He had seen the Alka-Seltzer commercial enough to say, I can't believe I ate the whole thing.
Oh, man.
Goodness.
Oh, that's awesome. See how old it is?
At the 40th reunion celebration, there were present a mixture of frog farmers and local people that they had made friends with during their time on the commune and since. The invite to the party had suggested that attendees bring old photos, stories and songs, as well as arthritis medication.
Jonathan.
One man who came treated us all to a mini fashion show of some of the T-shirts that the frog farmers have made a tradition of designing and producing to mark each passing year since the commune's inception, including the very first one.
And some girl named Cheryl embroidered the whole time. We never could get her out on the tobacco fields.
But all this merrymaking does not mean that life on the frog farm was without its challenges, one of which concerned finances.
We made really a bold attempt at collective economy. We would work in doing field work. It was not unusual for some of the guys to do construction work. There was a brief period where several of the women here worked in a local sewing factory. People would receive paychecks and just sign them over to the Flying Frog Farm.
But the paychecks were often few and far between.
That was difficult sometimes, just trying to pay the mortgage, and pay the bills, the typical problems everyone has that's living in poverty, because we were.
But the good things that we were doing is that we were had enough eventually, we're raising enough vegetables to freeze and can, and young people would come, both locals, meaning farmers, and other young people from Bowling Green would come out on Sundays, and we would have these softball games and cook huge pots of spaghetti for whoever happened to be there.
And we had a lot of music nights. We had so many in the frog farm who played. Michael, of course. Joy has a wonderful voice. Jim Brown was playing the drums a lot in those days. He had a full set of drums in our living room, set up all the time. And our living room, as you know, is not that big. But the music was fabulous, especially when we were outside around a fire. It just seemed like magic.
The softball games and the music making have continued to be a big feature of the reunions. Back in the 1970s, there were several married couples amongst the frog farmers, and after a while, babies began to add to the commune's population. Paula, who married Jim Brown on the farm, became the first frog farm mother with their son Joshua. Michael and Joy Gramling were the next couple to become pregnant.
They had decided that they were going to go to Stephen Gaskin's farm in Tennessee, which was a quite large, quite famous commune.
That place had a reputation for pioneering the natural approach to childbirth, which is something that Joy and Michael were interested in, so they went to stay there.
A few of us took a trip down there to visit Michael and Joy, and they had a gate on their farm. And we were stopped at the gate, and they wouldn't let us in. And I remember they said we couldn't come into their farm because we had to be aware of the karma of our gig. I remember that quite clearly. And I think it had to do with the fact that we were farming tobacco. So they wouldn't let us in. So we drove back home, and then shortly after that, Michael and Joy came back to our farm and said that they were going to have cotton at home.
I wanted to have my baby at the farm so that I could do it the way I wanted to do it, which was natural childbirth, no drugs, no forceps, no doctor telling me what to do, basically. And there's another piece to it also. You have to remember that we lived through the Vietnam War, but we were anti-war pacifists. So having the baby at home meant that my child wouldn't have a birth certificate, which would eventually mean that the draft board wouldn't know about him.
So the decision was made that Paula would be the midwife by virtue of the fact that she'd had a baby, and Michael, Joy's husband, would be her assistant. Both read up on the subject vociferously.
The day I went into labor was July 4th, and traditionally we would have a big party and a softball game. So all that actually went on, only without me. I was in labor all day. I guess I started off 9 o'clock in the morning. My husband stayed with me. We danced and walked around and, you know, just passed the time. And Paula did a magnificent job, as well as my husband. By 9 o'clock that evening, my son was born.
And there were probably a dozen people in the cabin cheering her on. And as soon as he was born, I dipped him in sterile water, like it said to do in the books, to make sure he was breathing, and he was. We passed him around. Cotton was held by a dozen different people before he was 5 minutes old, and it was like pretty miraculous, actually.
The problem was I had this condition that runs in my family, and the placenta did not separate from the uterus, so I actually ended up passing out.
And at that point, I looked at Michael and said, "That's it. We're calling an ambulance." And we did call an ambulance and sort of let them think that we had just waited too long. And that's why the Cotton was born at home. Happily, Joy was okay, and Cotton was okay. But it was probably the bravest and the most idiotic decision I ever made.
Cotton Gramling, born in a log cabin in Kentucky on the 4th of July, now lives in Thailand. The arrival of babies at the Frog Farm contributed to a change in the dynamic.
I think when we began to have children, I don't know, we tended to want to be more nuclear family at that point. So I think that's when it got a little harder.
I think probably 6 years of that close living and never having anything yourself. People finally kind of grew up. I think that was mostly it. I think we just kind of outgrew it.
I quite clearly remember I had Joshua in a backpack. I was pregnant with Nathan, and I was walking from the tobacco barn where we stored our firewood, pushing a wheelbarrow load of wood back to the cabin, and I remember thinking to myself, if I keep doing this, I am going to be 40 and I'm going to look like I'm 80. And when we decided that we were going to leave, that's when we decided that we had to disband officially.
And that was a tense time, because we had come into this very wide-eyed, having not really considered questions of breaking up the farm. We had gone in with this idea that we were creating this commune that was going to be part of a larger reformation of Western culture, but it didn't work out that way.
I mean, you're looking at a legal situation where there's 11 names on the deed and all kinds of communal property. It was extremely civil. Nobody saw a lawyer. We agreed how to split the money up. We did the communal property by just going around and each of us saying what we wanted. I want the cow. I'll take the junker car.
Certain people decided they wanted to keep the property. Jim and I didn't want it. Michael and Joy still had some acres. Alvin has some. And the people who were going to keep some of the property made the financial arrangements, and at some point Jim and I got a few thousand dollars out of it. And we left in the fall of 1976.
Maybe when it broke up, people blamed each other. But it didn't take us very much distance from it at all and said, oh my God, it's not that it broke up, it's that it lasted all that time. The folks that were part of it are still my lifelong friends. I've really not made friends like that since. My children grew up on it. My son Will, he's still living on it, so it's still very much part of my life.
And it's remained part of the lives of pretty well all of the original frog farmers. Some, as you heard, still own parts of the property, and others return every year for an annual hoedown that happens in September, or every 5 years for reunions that last for several days, like the one that took place around the 4th of July this year. Of course, all their lives have gone in different directions. Paula and her husband, for example, weren't able to make it to this year's reunion because of home commitments in Baltimore. But Al, who still owns part of the farm, was there, as were Joy and Michael. They are now divorced, but their younger son lives on the property they kept on the farm. And February was able to come down from her home in Maryland. And it was such a privilege for me to be present amongst these people who had gathered to make music and food and play softball together for 40 years in beautiful Allen County. Places are containers of culture and meaning, and the Flying Frog Farm is, for many, a very special place. I'll leave the last words of this program to Paula, Al, February, and Joy.
Your early 20s are quite important time for anyone, no matter what they're doing. And to have tried a different style of living is certainly something that I'm glad that I did. I don't think it changed me fundamentally as a person, but I think it gave me a greater understanding of what it takes to get along with other adults. I still hold very warm feelings for everyone that I lived with down there because we were so young and we were so foolish and we made so many mistakes.
I think living here as part of the Flying Frog Farm in Allen County, Kentucky, in America in 1972, was an absolutely wondrous experience. And I consider myself most fortunate to have found myself here then.
For me, it really hasn't died. The Flying Frog Farm is very much alive in my head, and I hope to possibly retire to that part of Kentucky, if I can, because I love it there. I still love it there. I feel very much at home there, and I would like to go back.
It's always been the Frog Farm still, and people still think of it as the Frog Farm, and our community has ebbed and flowed, but the spirit still seems to be there. And I think we've passed that on to the next generation as well. They're into the hoedowns and the softball games. So it's a living, breathing thing that no one of us has any control over.